I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Saturday's Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, turned deadly on Saturday afternoon when a 32-year-old woman named Heather Heyer was killed and 19 were injured by a motorist using his car as a weapon slamming into the crowd. James Alex Fields was arrested and will be in court today facing charges of second-degree murder and hit and run. He was one of hundreds of white supremacists, some of whom carried Confederate and Nazi flags and weapons, who went to the city to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. They were met with nonviolent counter-demonstrators, and they clashed with other groups in incidents of hand-to-hand combat. Two Virginia state troopers were killed when their helicopter crashed. President Trump spoke on Saturday.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. This has been going on for a long, long time. It is no place in America. What is vital now is a swift restoration of law and order and the protection of innocent lives.
David Duke, former Imperial Wizard of the KKK, was in Charlottesville this weekend, and he said this.
This represents a turning point for the people of this country. We are determined to take our country back. We're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. That's what we believed in. That's why we voted for Donald Trump, because he said he's going to take our country back, and that's what we got to do.
Peter Simi is associate professor at Chapman University, director of the Earl Babbie Research Center. He has studied extremist groups, including violent gangs and political extremists. He wrote a book called American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. Pete Simi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what should a president say if they want to condemn violent extremist groups so that they hear this message?
Well, President Trump got a couple things right. The part about, you know, this being a very old problem is certainly historically accurate. This is this type of terrorism that we saw in Charlottesville, emanates from really the oldest type of terrorism in our country's history. The oldest terrorist group is the Ku Klux Klan, founded, you know, shortly after the Civil War. So he did get that part right. But what he did was create a false equivalency when he talked about many sides. And that's, I think, the part that's most troubling and most concerning. And that's the part that should be corrected.
Well, let me just pick up on a couple of things, because I want to quote from the Daily Stormer. This is a white supremacist website. The Daily Stormer said he didn't attack us, talking about the president. Mm-hmm. He refused to answer a question about white nationalists supporting him. No condemnation at all. When asked to condemn, he just walked out of the room. Really, really good. God bless him. What are they saying?
Well, I saw some of those posts Saturday on the Daily Stormer. I was monitoring the site to see how they were responding to Trump's President Trump's comments, and what they're saying is that he's continuing this very kind of ambiguous message that they're interpreting as favorable. Right? That from the get go, from the moment he announced his candidacy, when he came down the escalator and talked about immigrants from Mexico being rapists, that was a signal to these types of groups and these kinds of individuals who have these kind of views that this person actually might be on our side. And from that moment, he continued to do things that consistently signaled these things. And this is just another step in that kind of a messaging that he's done since the beginning of his candidacy. So he's got a longstanding problem that he needs to correct. And I also would point out, elephant in the room, is he has several people working in the White House that these individuals see as comrades of sorts. So that's also part of the problem that needs to be corrected.
Well, let me pick up on several of those things. I've heard some people compare Black Lives Matter to the KKK. Does that hold up from your perspective as someone who has looked at extremist groups?
No, it really doesn't. Again, false equivalency. The KKK was founded in the name of white supremacy. It wanted to restore essentially the Confederacy, the principles of the Confederacy, which are obviously based on white supremacy. The KKK from very early on started using violent tactics and then ultimately waged a guerrilla, you know, was part of a guerrilla war that happened, you know, during Reconstruction era, where literally thousands of people were murdered by groups like the Klan, not just the Klan, but many other paramilitary groups that formed in the former Confederacy. And since that time, the KKK has consistently utilized violent tactics of, you know, terrorist tactics as part of their way to address the grievances that they have. Black Lives Matter was founded, you know, really as a response to combat violence, right? You know, so to really equate Black Lives Matter with the KKK is really just unthinkable in my view.
You mentioned the administration, Steve Bannon, who is a chief advisor to the president. When he headed up Breitbart, said it was the platform for the alt-right. We know about Steve Miller and some of his ties to mm-hmm. questionable people. Sebastian Gorka, with mm-hmm. a bit of his background there. These people work for the president. Does that send a message to these white extremist groups, these white supremacists, that they are safe in America? They are welcome in this country?
Yes. I mean, just, you know, bluntly, yes, it absolutely does. And you can, you know, that message is heard when you listen to what these folks are saying and you see the amount of support. I mean, one of the things that was, you know, really troubling, disconcerting about President Trump's candidacy was how much excitement and optimism he generated among, you know, the far right white supremacist type groups. Which is not typical. It's, you know, in 20 years of studying these groups, this is the most amount of kind of excitement or optimism I've seen in those two decades. Usually they don't get excited about, you know, so-called mainstream national politicians.
What is the KKK today? I mean, we saw these people with neo-Nazi flags. We saw them with Confederate flags. We heard them denigrating African-Americans, Jews, gay people. What do these groups want?
Well, when you say what is the KKK, one of the things that's important to point out is, you know, today the KKK's probably most, you know, greatest significance is its historical legacy and the role that it played in earlier historical time periods. Today, you know, the KKK is actually a small piece of a much larger kind of universe or constellation or subculture of these types of extremists. And one of the things that we're seeing recently is a younger generation of folks getting involved who, in many cases, are relatively well-educated and quite tech-savvy. There's two issues I think that are most central to what's kind of galvanizing these folks. One is the idea of race and that white males in particular are kind of on the ropes, so to speak, that their role in society is lessening in prominence. Their power is lessening. And then coupled with that is this idea of so-called Western civilization or European culture also being on the ropes, fading away, this fear that it's going to cease to exist. And so you see this, you know, globally, really, you're seeing these kind of concerns expressed in Europe and then certainly in the United States as well. And in particular, the issue that's the focal point is so-called non-white immigration. Right. And so there's a strong anti-Muslim element that's galvanizing these folks and a strong just anti-immigration aspect, a lot of xenophobia. And so that's really, I think, the current kind of rallying point for a lot of these folks.
Let me ask you about homegrown terrorism or domestic terrorism. I've seen the FBI and other groups say that that's actually a greater, if not threat, that they have had. There are more incidents from homegrown terrorists than from outside or foreign terrorists. Is that true?
Yeah. You know, if you look at since, you know, kind of post 9/11, the number of Americans killed in the United States by extremists up until the Orlando attack, you know, far-right extremists had killed more Americans. They were more lethal than violent jihadi Muslim extremists. You know, that the numbers are obviously, you know, ebb and flow. It's dynamic depending on, you know, what point you're looking. But I think the big takeaway is that far-right extremists, in terms of the amount of terrorism they engage in, is really overlooked. And we really don't see it the way we see Islamic terrorism, which obviously is what gets most people's attention.
What should happen next? And we're living in this world where there's another news story every hour or so. But if we want to stay focused on what happened in Charlottesville, what's the conversation we should have?
Well, yeah, we need to have conversations about this, and there needs to be some really tough conversations. And I think we have to, what part of the conversation needs to be what is attracting some people to these types of groups, and what kinds of how are these issues manifesting and these kinds of fears and angers, and is there a way to have some discussions about these issues without just demonizing each other? And so, part of the problem is that we so often communicate with others, in our echo chambers and dominated by social media. So we're only having conversations with people who see the world the way we do. And so having a more difficult dialogue across very divergent, points of view is very difficult to do today, but it's what's needed, I think.
We're almost out of time here. We've had former skinheads, former neo-Nazis on the show, people that have given up this this ideology and, frankly, this way mm-hmm. of life. And they often talk about feeling having family problems, for instance, feeling alone, looking for belonging to some group that represents or can acknowledge their existence. That's a more psychological piece. But do you think there's some mm-hmm. truth to that?
Absolutely. We've been doing a lot of work with former extremists and looking into their backgrounds, and we're finding some real common denominators, lots of kind of childhood adversity, not so much financially, but in terms of experiencing physical abuse, sexual abuse, just family instability, substance abuse in the home. So by the time they get to adolescence, they've developed some pretty strong negative emotional kind of susceptibility, and lots of anger, lots of depression. And so these groups represent kind of an outlet for that, and a way to direct and channel that anger and frustration and sadness. And so, obviously one of the intervention points becomes, how do we get to young kids before they get to the point of, turning towards these groups. And, we don't do a good job in terms of mental health outreach for anyone in our country, frankly. Hmm.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. Pete Simien, we called a lot of people yesterday, and we're happy to have you on the show and giving us a lot to think about and talk about. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Pete Simien, director of the Earl Babbie Research Center, also an associate professor of sociology at Chapman University. He studies extremist groups and violence and wrote a book called American Swastika: Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. Take a very short break, and then we're going to shift gears talking about the Goldwater Rule meets the duty to warn. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Back in the 1970s, when Barry Goldwater was running for president, Fact magazine ran a story with this sensational and misleading headline: 1,189 psychiatrists say Goldwater is psychologically unfit to be president. After losing to Lyndon Johnson, Goldwater successfully sued Fact for libel, and the American Psychiatric Association instituted the Goldwater Rule that forbids its members from diagnosing public figures that they have not examined. Now, more than 40 years later, the Goldwater Rule is being challenged by some members of the APA and other psychological organizations. Our guest, John Gartner, is one of those people. He is a psychologist, founder of Duty to Warn, who says that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. He wrote a book a few years ago titled In Search of Bill Clinton, A Psychological Biography. John Gartner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Christy Ashwanden. She says not so fast. She's lead science writer for 538, wrote a recent article titled Diagnosing Trump is More About Politics Than Mental Health. Christy Ashwanden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is an issue, I should add, that has divided a number of mental health organizations, so it's a pretty live and lively topic. John Gardner, let me begin with you, and let's say you have someone in your office, so they are sitting across from you, first-time patient, you're trying to figure out what is wrong with them. What kinds of questions, what do you do to come up with, if not a diagnosis, at least a sense of why they are either in trouble or conflicted?
I think we have to put this in context. Today, we stand on the brink of nuclear holocaust, in part because the American Psychiatric Association successfully silenced the voices of conscience within our profession. And today, as a result, we have a Nazi coddling madman with a nuclear gun pointed at the world's head shouting, "I'll do it, don't push me, I'll do it." And you know what? He will, because he's crazy. And that's something the voters should have been warned about before the election, before it was too late.
How did you decide that, having never met Donald Trump?
Well, his actions and his words point to someone who is dangerous. Whether or not you want to assign him a psychiatric diagnosis, and obviously I've argued that we can, we have enough evidence from his behavior to know that this is an impulsive, dishonest, paranoid, vindictive person who lashes out in ways that are destructive. This person is now got us all under the nuclear gun. So whether or not you think we can diagnose him, we have missed the big picture here, which is that we failed to warn the public that millions of lives were at risk. And at this point, I think it's too late.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Christy. What do you say back to John Gardner? He says that we have a president who is crazy.
Well, first of all, I guess I would say that I think that the term crazy is an inappropriate term to use. I think it's a stigmatizing word. I don't think that it's a good word to use. But I want to be really clear from the start about what this discussion is about. This is not a discussion about whether Trump is fit for office. That's really a political question. This is a discussion about whether it's appropriate for mental health professionals to diagnose him from a distance and then to use this diagnosis as a reason to disqualify him from office. And I would say that the answer to both of those questions is no. Look, all of the behaviors that Gardner is referring to here are things that Trump exhibited during the campaign, previous to the campaign. I mean, this is a guy who spent years promoting a conspiracy theory that was demonstrably false about President Obama. So I'm sort of a little bit puzzled at what sort of power he thinks psychiatrists have to change the voting public's minds. All of these things, we can judge a President Trump's fitness for office, right, by his behavior, and he has provided ample evidence for his fitness there, and this evidence was apparent before the election. And the voting public rewarded him for this behavior by electing him to office. So I don't know that psychiatrists coming out during the election and saying, this guy is crazy, I don't see how that changes things.
Well, John Gardner, picking up on what Chrissy Ashwanan just said and a couple of things that you said earlier, and it's pretty clear that what the president has done and said in the last 6 months is very similar to what he said on the campaign trail. I think people that have covered him as a businessman would say this is who this man is, and enough people in this country voted him into office.
People had the misimpression that once he won the election, he was going to settle down and, quote, pivot to being more presidential. If we had informed the public about what we know about this type of malignant narcissistic character, we could have informed them and warned them that the exact opposite would happen, that people of this type become more dangerous when they gain power. They don't get better. They get worse. Their grandiosity becomes inflamed, and their paranoia becomes inflamed, and they become more reckless in their behavior. This is what all paranoid dictators have done from the beginning of time. And if we had warned the public that this is what they could have expect, we wouldn't be on the verge of a nuclear holocaust right now. Let's remember the Goldwater Rule didn't come down from Mount Sinai. Behind closed doors at the AP Ethics Committee, and I know this from witnesses who were in the room, it was said that we have to affirm Goldwater or else Trump will lower our reimbursement rates. The APA is a professional guild organization that protects the interests of the profession, not the people. And the Goldwater Rule is an example of APA corruption, not ethics.
Let me quote Alan Francis. He was chairman of the task force that wrote the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And you, John Gartner, called the president having a problem of narcissistic personality disorder. Alan Francis said, I wrote the criteria that define this disorder, and Mr. Trump does not meet them. He may be a world-class narcissist, but this doesn't make him mentally ill because he does not suffer from the distress and impairment required to diagnose mental disorder. He's saying, I wrote this diagnosis. He does not fit this criteria.
Well, Al Francis is a bit of a narcissist to claim that
he's not here to defend. That is really a not fair thing to say, John Gardner.
Well, his argument is wrong on three counts.
I mean, you can argue with someone, but please don't call him a narcissist because you don't know
well,
that.
Well, he's wrong on three counts. Can I define them?
You can do that.
Okay. Number one, he is in distress. He's up all night screaming at the television anytime anyone says anything bad about him. Number two, the thing about personality disorders is their main claim to fame is that they cause distress to others while being in denial about the effect that they're having. And finally, it is impairing his functioning. From the very first day he became president, he announced delusionally that he had the largest crowd size in history. So from the very first day, his mental illness, and by the way, I am not stigmatizing people with mental illness. We're talking about the worst 0.1% of people with mental illness and the most dangerous characteristics you can possibly have in a leader, narcissism, paranoia, antisocial personality disorder, and sadism. These are the components that Eric Fromm used to define Hitler and Stalin and other such sadistic dictators. And this is the psychology of Donald Trump. And lo and behold, what did we see yesterday? But people with red Make America Great hats saying, Heil Trump.
Let me go back to you, Kristi Ashwanan, and you also quoted from Alan Francis saying bad behavior is rarely a sign of mental illness. Can you respond to what John Gartner has been saying?
Yeah, I guess one question I would like to ask Mr. Gartner is what purpose a diagnosis serves here. I mean, it goes back to President Trump's behavior, which is, you know, frankly reprehensible and repugnant. His response to Charlottesville was, you know, there's no excuse for that, but that's behavior that we can judge. We don't need a mental health diagnosis there to help us. And so I'm not sure how a mental health diagnosis is different than just simply judging the man on his behaviors, on his actions. And, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, if it were that he had some sort of medical condition that were to disqualify him from office, that would mean invoking the 25th Amendment. Mm-hmm. But then we're back to politics. I mean, that would require the cabinet and the GOP leadership basically to say, yes, this man's unfit. And so, again, it's not the doctors that you need to convince. It's the politicians.
Go ahead, John Gardner. What is the purpose of having a diagnosis like this or labeling
somebody?
As
I just explained, many people believed that Donald Trump was being a showman, that he was just trying to rile up his base. But then once he became president, he would do the rational thing and become more presidential, that he would pivot. If the public had known the truth that this is someone who suffers from a severe, deep personality disorder, then they would have had the information that in fact he would not pivot and become more presidential. He would not live up to the office. In fact, he would escalate and become more paranoid, more narcissistic, more reckless, and more dangerous. I think the public had a right to know that before it's too late. Now he's got the nuclear codes, and in 10 minutes he can blow up the world. Would have been nice if we'd known that before the election.
A diagnosis is not 100% predictive of behavior, though.
The diagnosis of malignant narcissism is, if you study history, all of the sadistic dictators who fit this personality profile have gone through very predictable steps. They all demonize minorities. They all terrorize their own population. They all delegitimize the press. They all purge the bureaucracy. This is fascism 101, and we are heading down the same road that Germany went down in the 1930s.
Well, we are not a dictatorship. We have branches of government. We've got a balance of powers. And while there are things that the president said that are disturbing and incendiary, when you look at what he's actually accomplished, he hasn't done many of the things, John Gardner, that he said he wanted to do.
I don't agree. I think the press has been delegitimized. Now, anyone who doesn't want to hear about the Russia investigation calls it fake news. What he's doing is eroding the checks and balances. He's attacking the institutions that preserve democracy that you're referring to. He's attacking the courts. He's attacking the press. He's attacking the bureaucrats within the government who are the experts about the environment, about Russia. All of these are the steps that happen on the way to the dissolution of democracy. And so to whistle through the graveyard and say, oh, don't worry, there are checks and balances, what we don't understand is that democracy is reversible. All the democracies have been reversed, going back to ancient Greece, and the steps are very predictable. And it begins with one of these megalomaniacal strongmen.
Chrissy, let me give you a chance. I keep having you respond to what John Gardner is saying, but go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I just want to go back to my very first point is that the things that Mr. Gardner just said may be true. I'm not going to argue with them at all. But again, we go back to, let's talk about the role here of a psychiatric diagnosis and whether it's appropriate for mental health professionals to diagnose people that they have not, personally treated or interacted with. And, you know, he talks about these other dictators having this disorder, but it sounds to me like this is all sort of a diagnosis that's being done in retrospect and looking back at things that have happened. We don't know what's going to happen from here. This is clearly a pretty strong test of our democratic system here and the checks and balances that are in place, and whether the system that we have has sufficient checks and balances for the situation that we have now, where we have such strong partisanship. Frankly, I don't see it being psychiatrists who have a chance here or a role to stop what's happening. That lies with the politicians and the GOP. And I'm still failing to see how a psychiatric diagnosis helps here.
Well, let me follow up on one or two things with you, Chrissy. And I read the article that you wrote, Diagnosing Trump is More About Politics and Mental Health. Are you concerned, though, with the diagnosis of malignant narcissist, that it does stigmatize mental health or mental illness?
Well, let's just do a little thought experiment, right? Like, what if Trump were to come out today and say, look, I have been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, malignant personality disorder. I'm getting treatment. Bear with me here. You can imagine Melania standing at his side. Maybe this is an issue she's going to take up, spouses of narcissistic personality disorder. What happens then? Do we just say, all right, that's it? We're still back to the same place. In that case, then the question is, is this enough to disqualify someone from office? And, I think a fundamental issue here is that we really don't have anything. There's no job description that's really laid out. There are very few criteria of what makes someone presidential. What we have are sort of societal norms, and Donald Trump has broken nearly all of them. But none of this is really codified, and we don't actually know how the 25th Amendment would play out here.
John Gardner,
but I do worry that once you start saying that having a mental disorder is enough to disqualify someone. I mean, we've had previous presidents who have had, in retrospect, what people have thought may have been mental health issues. For instance, Abe Lincoln probably had depression. I don't think anyone would say that he should have been disqualified from office.
Do you want him, John Gardner? Do you want him removed from office?
We do, and we have a petition that has been signed by 60,000 people, a petition for mental health professionals. that has said that he is mentally unfit and needs to be removed from office. We're having meetings all across the United States on October 14th, duty to warn town halls, in which we will be organizing to get that message out. And we are supporting House Resolution 1986, which would establish a presidential commission to evaluate a president for removal under the 25th Amendment, should that be necessary. But I have to say that your other guest is simply not listening to me. I'm not saying that all mental health problems would disqualify someone from office. I said that explicitly. And your thought experiment is absurd because he would never, someone with this diagnosis would never say, I suffer from this illness and I'm seeking treatment. The nature of this illness is that they do not think they have an illness and that they attack and demonize other people in defense of their own narcissism. These types of people are severely dangerous. And so this is not an issue of him being someone who suffers from anxiety or depression. This is an example of someone who is destructive to other people because of his pathology. You mentioned him violating norms. That's one of the primary criteria for antisocial personality disorder. Lying is one of the fundamental criteria. Violating and exploiting the rights of others is one of the primary criteria. And expressing no remorse is one of the primary criteria. Those are observable behavioral criteria that we use in making diagnosis since the DSM was brought into play. And so it's not a mystery. Does he lie? Does he violate and exploit the rights of others? Does he violate norms? Does he show no remorse? Those are the criteria for antisocial personality disorder. Interviewing him would not give me any new information. Having him lie to my face wouldn't give me new information. We have enough information from his public behavior to know that he meets these simple observable behavioral criteria.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's John Gartner. He is a psychologist, founder of Duty to Warn. He says that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. He is calling him a malignant narcissism. Christy Ashwanden is lead science writer for 538, wrote a recent article titled Diagnosing Trump is More About Politics Than Mental Health. And as I said earlier, this is a pretty bold and dramatic fight that is taking place within mental health organizations. You're getting a flavor for what the discussion, what the debate is about. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about a discussion, a debate within the mental health community. Some saying that we have enough information to make observations and make a diagnosis of our president. Others saying that armchair diagnoses are often wrong. They can be harmful to a person or to a family and can hurt the profession and raising questions about confidentiality. Our phones just exploded at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Christy, let me go back to you. And I did a little digging when it came to what happened back in the 1970s with Barry Goldwater. Fact Magazine did get sued. Interestingly, the survey was sent out to something like 12,000 psychiatrists. Only about 80% responded. And yes, why? While 1,189 psychiatrists said Goldwater was psychologically unfit to be president, almost the same number said he was perfectly sane. Now, that was almost 50 years ago. Is the Goldwater rule still a rule we should abide by today?
Well, I mean, I don't, I'm a journalist. I'm not a psychiatrist. So I feel like I want to be careful about overstepping, my role here. But I will just say that, the American Psychiatric Association stands by the rule. The American Psychological Association, it's very confusing. There are three groups.
All APAs, right?
Yeah. But they are standing by it or standing in support of it as well. And I want to talk a little bit about the Goldwater case. Looking back at this Fact Magazine article, this was not that long ago, it was 1964 that this ran. And yet reading it now, it feels extremely dated. It's very clear that our thoughts and our ideas about mental illness have changed a lot. At that time, there was sort of posturing and sort of sinister insinuations that Goldwater's father was a homosexual, which at that time was a diagnosable mental disorder. You know, of course, today things are much, much different. So the other issue that I think we need to think about here is that our understanding of mental illness and mental health is still evolving. It's something that changes. There's a large cultural component to some of these things. And narcissistic personality disorder is a disorder that had some bit of controversy about sort of the specifics about it and diagnostic criteria. So it's very possible that, you know, 40, 50 years from now, we'll think very differently about it. So I think, you know, in terms of what a diagnosis is useful for, usually the way that it's used at this point in time is to help an individual who is seeking care. You know, the diagnosis is helpful to figure out a treatment plan, to help people get that help, and, you know, frankly, to get insurance coverage. You know, the extent to which it's helpful to diagnose a public figure is much less clear to me.
John Gardner, let me give you a chance to respond, and we got a lot of people that want to join our conversation.
Well, it's important to realize this is not a normal situation. This is not a normal president. So whatever we might say about the Goldwater rule in general, people shouldn't go on Oprah, for example, and speculate wildly about public figures. This was a once in a 240-year disaster. This was a one time in the history of our nation emergency, and we failed to heed the call. We didn't warn people that this was the real thing. This was not the Goldwater case, which, in fact, you're right, was libel. And actually, the authors that wrote that paper weren't even honest. They didn't even report the data honestly. Right now, our understanding of mental health has evolved in that we now have the DSM, which allows us to have very objective behavioral criteria. In those days, it was the Freudians who were saying he was latent homosexual, or he had scarred by his potty training. Now we simply need to know, does he lie? Does he violate norms? Does he show a lack of remorse? Those are the criteria for antisocial. And antisocial isn't something you suffer from. It's something that causes you to make other people suffer. The point is, he has an illness, but an illness that causes him to be destructive to other people. And that's what we fail to warn the public about.
But the DSM is updated, you know, periodically because diagnoses change. We learn more about mental illness and mental health. So it's not as if the DSM is written in stone.
Oh, no, it's always evolving. What was different about the DSM, the great advance, was that it tried to make diagnosis something that was based on observable behavioral criteria, not some abstract construct or speculation. That's why I keep reading these sentences over and over again. They're so simple, so direct, so obvious. Either someone lies or they don't lie. We know Donald Trump lies. It's been documented.
Well, we certainly have had other presidents who have lied to us.
Well, not in the same way. They might lie about something that they are embarrassed about, but not lying every 3 minutes and 15 seconds, according to Politico.
Christine, go ahead, and then we'll get some callers in.
Yeah, sure. So, look, all of these behaviors that you're describing are out there in the open for everyone to see. The voters have seen them. We see them. They're continuing to this day. I don't see how putting a diagnosis on this changes anything.
Well, and let me go back to Alan Francis, and don't call him a narcissist, John Gardner, but this is this piece that he wrote in the New York Times. He said, bad behavior is rarely a sign of mental illness, and the mentally ill behave badly only rarely.
Well, this is one of those rare cases. That's my point, is that someone with this degree of evil, we're talking about a personality disorder that makes someone truly evil.
Is evil in the DSM?
Yes. Antisocial personality disorders are evil. People who take pleasure from harming other people, who feel no guilt about it, who do it as a pattern of behavior, that I would say is evil. And when you combine that with some mental disorder such as paranoia, where he believes he's the victim of crazy conspiracy theories, and he demonizes minorities and the press and anyone who opposes him. When you combine evil with paranoid misperceptions and impulsivity and reckless behavior. This is a toxic combination, and I'm sorry, but our profession does have something to add to this debate. We do know a few things, and we know that those behaviors are predictive of destructive, dangerous, impulsive behavior. We know that. And it's our job to warn the people that we see something. If there was a bomb on an airplane, and I had special technical expertise that made me aware of that, what ethical principle would keep me from warning the passengers?
Let me get Steve from Newtown to join our conversation. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, of course, what Trump has going for him is we're not allowed to diagnose people who aren't our patients. But both your guests have some points here. I spent a career in the military as a mental health professional eliminating personality disorders because they are not fit for service and they're not adaptable.
Exactly.
And certainly if I had any soldier that continued to say the commander-in-chief was not a U.S. citizen or that we don't abide by the Geneva Convention, we should get rid of it or kill family members of terrorists, or that what did the geniuses in the Pentagon think when they put women in the military, thereby justifying sexual assault, or the epitome, asking the enemy to spy upon the United States, asking Putin, they would be eliminated if they didn't back off those views. And with personality disorders, of course, they don't back off those views because this is their belief system, but they're not in distress. My main point is, America doesn't look at this right. They look at the personality disorder. They know nothing about it. They think of mental illness as someone in distress, and, of course, almost all mental illness is. The DSM says clinically significant distress, or that or is important. With personality disorders, they don't come into mental health with depression, anxiety. They get in trouble. They have impairment. In my case, in the military, they violate the UCMJ. Uniform Code of Military Justice. So the frustration of having somebody in charge of the military who probably would have been eliminated from the military, especially with the habitual lying about everything, especially the most important issue, the Russian hacking and cyber warfare, that person would be eliminated unless somehow they actually were joking and very quickly we found out it was a joke over a few beers versus their philosophy.
Yeah, I got to jump in here only because we had a lot of people that want to join us and I want to give our guests a chance to respond. And Christine, one part of John Gartner's book is, his organization, his group is called Duty to Warn. Do you think psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists have a duty to warn?
I don't think that that's a question for me, actually. I think that's a question for the field of psychiatry. And, you know, from my reporting, it looks to me like the field is kind of split into two camps on this.
Do you see that, John Gartner? You see your organization splitting?
Well, the field is definitely split on this issue. We know that we have an overarching obligation to educate and protect the welfare of the public. That's in the preamble of the American Psychological Association Code of Ethics and the American Psychiatric Association Code of Ethics. So we have a broad obligation to educate and protect the welfare of the public in general as our overarching principle. And specifically, as a result of the Tarasov case where a psychologist was told that his patient was going to murder someone and didn't warn them, It's now the law in 33 states. And, of course, this obviously applies to the individual case of knowing that we have a patient who might harm someone. We have a duty to warn that person. And so those who have argued against have said, well, this Donald Trump is not our patient, and so we don't have this same duty. But if we have a duty to break confidentiality, which is actually one of our most sacred ethical principles, in order to potentially save a life, how much more is our ethical burden to save the lives of millions of people?
Do you want a psychological test for someone to decide their fitness for office?
That has been proposed by Ted Lieu and Jason Chaffetz, that there be a psychiatrist in the White House who might do some preliminary exam or be available for a consultation or evaluation should that prove necessary. That's certainly a proposal that our organization is in favor of, as well as the House Resolution 1986, which establishes a commission for evaluating a president for removal under the 25th Amendment.
What do you think about that, Christine? Then we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, I think that's totally appropriate. And I think that, you know, these recent events and the election of Donald Trump, certainly, you know, it's demonstrated a flaw in the system. We don't have this. It's something that we probably never knew was necessary. I think it would be perfectly appropriate to do that, but that's something that sort of has to be done in advance, unfortunately, one would think.
Well, going back to what you said about Abraham Lincoln, if he was clinically depressed, you know, Christine, would he have passed that test? I mean, obviously it didn't exist 100 and some years ago.
Right. That's hard to say. And I think it's extremely hard to speculate, you know, on past events like that. But I think what this would do is sort of the creation of these rules or this list of things necessary to serve would be an opportunity to sort of really pin down what is it that is necessary and what are the things. And there again, I think it would be, I would imagine that it would be most appropriate to list behaviors and sort of traits and things like that rather than, whether a particular mental health diagnosis would automatically disqualify someone, that's hard to say. You know, that would have to be decisions that would be made by, trying to imagine who would come up with this. You would imagine that, you know, some psychiatrists would be involved, perhaps military people, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is sort of a code like this in the military that could serve as perhaps a guide. But again, this is something that would need to be worked out. And in that case, it would be appropriate to ask whether the person, fit those criteria. And I just want to be really clear here, too. I'm not arguing against all of the things that Mr. Gardner is saying about President Trump's behavior, but it's the behavior. And I think really the fundamental question here is, you know, whether offering or giving President Trump a diagnosis really changes anything or makes a difference. And I'm still trying to see how that would be the case.
I hear you. And I'm sure you want to respond to that, John Gardner. But
it's the difference of millions of dead people. That's the difference. Can you see that as being a meaningful distinction?
How does psychiatrists, I mean, the people who elected him, the GOP who continues to support him, has at their before their eyes all of these behaviors that you're talking about. I don't know how the diagnosis suddenly changes their behavior, their response.
Well, the caller put it much more articulately than I did, actually. He explained that his job was to weed people out of the military who might show these traits because they would be dangerous. It's that simple.
You keep
the
saying
situation here, we don't actually have that codified. We don't have, there's no psychiatrist. There's no one, that job is not in the Constitution. It's not in, making this, I mean, these ideas are out there and it hasn't made a difference from what I can tell.
And I hate to do this only because we're almost out of time here, but John Gardner, you've said several times during this interview that there are going to be millions of dead people because we have President Trump. You stand 100% behind that? I mean, if he stays in office, we're going to face that kind of annihilation?
Yes.
Yes,
we are.
You're absolutely,
Garrett,
you're saying 10 years from now, we can call you up and say, and we'll be talking about the millions of dead people because of President Trump.
I wish I were wrong, but what we know in the profession about people who have this kind of psychological makeup is they act on their destructive impulses. They actually get pleasure from chaos and mayhem and pain. They enjoy their sense of power from being omnipotently destructive. This is not a bluff. This is not the madman theory. This is a madman.
And you're saying no one will stop him?
According to the law of the United States, no one can stop him. The law of the United States says 10 minutes after he punches in the numbers into the nuclear football, the birds have to be in the air. We set it up that way in case we had a surprise attack by the Russians. We never changed it. No one else has to sign off on it. No one else has to turn a key. He can blow up the world in 10 minutes, in any 10-minute period at any time, and he will.
We have to end on that note. John Gardner, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, psychologist, founding member of Duty to Warn. Christine Ashwanden, thank you for joining us as well, lead writer for Science at 538. And I do wish we had more time to discuss this, and my apologies to our many callers that wanted to join the conversation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this show. You can also jump in on the conversation that we posted on Facebook earlier today. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri, with assistance today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.